Very pleased to be sharing today with Peter Singer is that he's one of the more open and honest folk in this area that I know, and that I deeply admire. I always say I never had enough faith to be an atheist, because you believe there is no God, you can't prove it, you get nothing on the deal, and you're responsible even for the weather. You know, I can't handle that. But transcendence matters, and the person who said it so beautifully, I don't know if you've ever read Arthur Leff. He's a lawyer. He's dead now. He taught common law at Yale. And he gave an absolutely stunning paper at Duke in 1979. And if you got time, Google him, Leff, 1979. The title is something like Unnatural Law, Unspeakable Justice. It's one of those titles you get the wrong way around very easily. But Arthur Leff, Duke Law Review, 1979 will do. It impressed me so much that the first paragraph left itself permanently in my memory, so I can repeat it. Perhaps with a few errors, but he says, I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete immanent, not imminent, but immanent, available to you, and transcendent set of propositions about right and wrong. Findable rules that direct us as to how to live our lives righteously. Now, as far as I can discover, he was a non-practicing Jew, and what he's asking for is that the Torah be true and that God speak it. Because then, both the judge and the judged are under the same authority. Justice is a possibility. He goes on, however, to say, I also want to believe, and so do you, in no such thing, but rather that we are wholly free to decide for ourselves what we ought to do and what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is to be simultaneously perfectly free and perfectly ruled. That is at the same time to discover the right and the good and to invent it. Now, even Americans can't have both. They're incommensurate in many ways. And because we have those two groups here, I actually think we need two practices of medicine based on the moral commitments and the rights to conscience. Your current president doesn't understand that, which is very dangerous. There are attacks on conscience throughout the world. Australia, actually in the state of Victoria, made it an offence not to refer for abortion, which is to make you an accomplice to an act that you might deem to be wrong. So I think patients have as much right to a doctor who shares their moral commitments as the other way around. And we need to be able to express it, put it up on our shingle, so to speak, and you know when you go to this doctor, that's what's going to happen in this hospital. And it should be, as we teach medicine, on a patient-centered fashion. We should arrange medicine in a patient-centered fashion by having the appropriate surveys to find what people believe and adjusting the medical system appropriately.
But I'd like to push you a little harder, because I think the question was a bit more specific than the answer you gave. I mean, what do you make of the argument that I made about brain death? Do you think actually, given your conception of human life, that it's wrong to be taking the hearts out of patients whose bodies are functioning but whose brains have ceased functioning?
Well, actually, we do turn off the respirator and the heart stops before it's taken. So actually, it's always a question of withdrawal of treatment. And I have no problem once you... Well, I put it like this. The duty of the doctor is to cure very occasionally, to alleviate often, and to comfort always. And that when a patient has entered upon their dying, and that is a difficult clinical judgment, then anything except comfort is meddlesome medicine. So I would have more problem with the people who are being kept on a respirator for no purpose. I think it's much more important not to start down that road wherever possible. I have no difficulties with removing artificial means of support, although one has to admit it's much easier not to start than it is to turn a respirator off. And that again is why I think some of the people who shout so loud about it should be called in at least to turn the respirator off, to have the sense of what that feels like. It's not a straightforward thing at all. There are depths to our being that we need to recognize and we need to be sensitive about. You will see far too many people in medicine who have become totally hardened. Now, I had to illustrate what I mean, amongst the students I took with me to Africa over the years was the class feminist, with whom I had, of course, many long discussions which never terminated in a conclusion on either side. But she was pre-clinical, and she was very definitely pro-life, pro-choice rather, as I had been for 20 years. And I said to her, well, you're starting clinical, you should go and help in the abortion clinic. I think people who are pro-abortion should go and assist Planned Parenthood. There's plenty of work they could do, and they ought to be involved in the atmosphere and find out what it's all about. Well, she did that. As it happened, she went into the abortion session in Ottawa, and it was the man who's been doing late-term abortions for a long while. And he has become what inevitably will happen to you. She walked in, he saw it, didn't inquire whether this was her first visit to a clinic or anything. He just said, good, a medical student, assemble that baby, see that all the bits are there, so that I can get on with my next case. And he did, in those two sentences, with his total insensitivity, more than I'd been able to do in 2 years. But that's what it had done to him. Do we have the right to make people that insensitive, that harsh? He wasn't like that when he started. And as you well know, abortionists don't go on doing abortion indefinitely in most cases. Some do, and they're the ones who are ideologically committed. But most of them don't, and the drug and alcohol usage of people who work in those institutions is legendary. There are consequences. And you have the right to refuse. But you better stay alert as to what's happening. If you're interested, my wife and I have set up a Hippocratic Registry of Physicians, because we've already seen in Canada some militants saying you shouldn't be allowed into medical school if you won't promise to do abortions when you leave. I think that's anti-democratic. I think it's wrong. And so we've started this registry, not hopefully never to have to activate it. All we want is your email addresses, so that if you are threatened in that way, or if in our country it would be the provincial government says that that's going to be a requirement for entry to medical school, we ought to get at least 30% of physicians to sign up, and we can push the button and say, tomorrow you do only emergency work. And the government will have to deal and divide the health system.
Gentlemen, this is from Dr. Patrick.
Yes.
So from what I gather from your talk, you'd be opposed to ascribing value to human life based upon certain measurable functional definitions. However, in your anecdote about the Mike Tyson Helen Keller incident, it seemed like you wouldn't be opposed to ascribing value to human life based on at least some potential functional, immeasurable benefits to society at large. And is that an accurate representation of
It's a bit more nuanced than that, but
And the second question is how would that be essentially different from Dr. Singer's position?
That's a good question. I need to think my way through that. I don't know exactly what his position is. But I am very concerned that with the tyranny of the measurable, that we confuse being able to measure something with being a total description of something. I mean, what we do in science always is to build a model of reality. Are models bigger or smaller than the reality? They're always smaller. So they're functional models in that they say, for instance, the model of the atom is sufficient to build a new antibiotic, but it won't explain quantum physics. In other words, the atom is not actually a perfect model of reality at that level. So it's scientism I'm opposed to. Dawkins is into scientism. He doesn't realize it, unfortunately. I love science. And the fact that I'm a Christian doesn't stop me doing science. When I started taking my faith seriously, I actually did science better, not worse, because I had some extra resources to apply to the temptations to short-circuit and manipulate data, which is always a temptation. Because I do want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. It helps. And I certainly have seen, my life has been immeasurably enriched by people who, many people would say, were going to have a life that was not worth living. In fact, one of the things that took me from I was pro-choice, I said I believed but didn't practice it in any way. I went to church because I liked what I had received from my parents and I wanted my children to have it. And in a little church in Jamaica where there was prayers from the congregation, I found myself going to that church to hear, hoping that one man in particular would pray. He was an illiterate, elderly Jamaican man. But when he prayed, I was listening to someone who was clearly talking to someone he knew, and I was envious. his life would be dismissed by these people who choose functional characteristics for what matters. I mean, it's the people with all the function that have caused all the trouble, isn't it? Down syndrome children have never done any harm in the world. And as the medieval said, the great thing about the so-called disabled is that, particularly the mentally disabled they're talking about, is that they carry no grudge into tomorrow. And if Princeton had everybody walking through the doors tomorrow with no grudges from yesterday, it would be a nicer place, wouldn't it?
Any human, yes. Any place with humans in it would be.
Yeah.
Sorry,
if there was a question I missed.
There's a lot of people raising hands, so I hope I will get through everyone. Gentlemen, in check for sure.
This is directed at Dr. Singer. I know you said that in a world in which we weren't overly straining our resources, it might be considered a bad thing to snuff out the potential life that is the developing fetus. And I've read Famine and Affluence, and I understand where you're coming from in terms of talking about the strains on our resources. But how do you justify your own existence within a strained world as an individual?
You mean why don't I say, well, this world has too many people in it, I can make it one fewer anyway?
not saying that would be worse off.
Yeah, well, you see, I mean, I guess I would do this in a number of different ways at different levels. At the largest level, I would say I justify it by trying to use my life to make the world a better place. I could also say, you know, now that I do exist, and now that I have a wife and children and even grandchildren, I hope that I can make their lives better and that their lives might be worse if I were suddenly to die. So I think there's both particular and general reasons. But, you know, obviously those things would not have applied if I had never been born. There wouldn't have been anybody who cared about me in that way. And whether I would or would not make a positive contribution to the world would be pretty much unknowable at that stage too.
So are those individuals who are potentially not affecting anyone but themselves and just simply living out their lives as a conscious being capable of, you know, all the faculties of any other being who is loved, known, etc., would you say that person's life would be better off not lived given their strained resources?
Well, I'm not quite sure that I understand the question you're asking, but if you're asking me, so would it have been better if they had never come into existence, if all they have done is live a life in which maybe, you know, to some extent they enjoyed it, but they were using up lots of resources, contributing to the global environmental problems and so on. And, you know, if obviously nobody would have minded if they'd not come into existence at that point, then I think my answer is probably yes. The world would be better with somewhat fewer people in it, and if you could selectively take out those who haven't contributed to making a better place in any way, that would be okay.
So to amplify that question, a recalcitrant criminal, someone with a chronic illness not able to proceed in life, or someone who is contributing to the general misery of the world in some way, that person should probably be removed?
Oh, no, I'm not at all saying that somebody should remove them once they're there in existence. If I understood the question correctly, it was whether it would have been better if they'd never come into existence. Once they're in existence, it's different because, for one thing, they may want to go on living and to do various other things in their lives. Even if they're not things that we value, they're things that they value. And that counts for them. Plus, of course, that there's family or whoever else they have to connect with.
Take the lady in front of that.
Who would be in charge besides this thing? If some people are potentially to benefit the society and some others wouldn't, because the final analysis, we're all humans. And we all are built with a human error. So how do we get in charge somebody to say, well, some are better not getting to the society? Because most of what
I think there's some misunderstanding here. I'm certainly not suggesting anything of the sort. The question, if I understood it correctly, was about whether it would have been better if some human beings had never come into existence, given that the world is overpopulated and crowded. That's a totally different thing from saying, once some people are in existence, someone, anyone else should decide which are the ones who are leading good lives and which are the ones who aren't, and get rid of the ones who aren't. I've never said anything like that.
You said something almost, well, you described as an easy case the terminally ill individual who is conscious and makes a decision that their life is no longer worth living and therefore wants to end their life. How about if we take out of the equation the imminence of death, so the Elizabeth Bouvet type situation where you've got somebody who could potentially live many decades, but they've got a severe physical condition. Their perception is that their condition, their life is no longer worth living. In that situation, which is more important, the consciousness or the autonomy of deciding?
I think we should respect the autonomy of people like that. Where this is something that they've thought about for a long time, they've been of this same view for quite a long time. In the end, I think it's their decision whether to go on living or not. So, you know, in that case, if you think that case is like the one that the woman at the back of the room was asking about, then my answer is, nobody else makes the decision, you make it for yourself. And I think if you do make it under those conditions of good decision making, I think that's your decision to make. So to that extent, I guess I do disagree with the requirement in the Oregon legislation that death be likely to be coming within 6 months. I can't remember exactly how it's phrased, but certain or likely. Anyway, two doctors have to say that you're not going to live more than 6 months. I think if you were, you know, incurably ill but had a long life expectancy and said, look, given this condition that I've got, I don't think life is worth living, I think it should also be permissible for the doctor to write you the prescription.
Just to add to that in Holland already a woman has been euthanized because she had chronic depression and she was fed up with taking medicines. She didn't want to. So you can push that along. I fear here the extension, because one of the common things you hear from people at the end of their lives is, oh, my life is not worth living. And there are too many people who would take that literally. In most cases, I believe it to be a lament. And what they are asking is for you to say, no, you're important to us. You have made our lives richer. We want to care for you. It's a privilege to care for you. I don't think that one person's right should become another person's obligation. And particularly amongst the elderly, there are a lot of people who are already beginning to feel, I'm too much of a burden. Now, that can, of course, be pure courage. I can remember again in an African village saying to a woman, well, your problem is such and such, and you need an operation. It can be done at the mission hospital. And she asked how much it would cost. And I told her, and she said, no, I can't do that. It would take the money for the children's school. I said, well, there's some charitable funds. But she was willing to sacrifice herself for her children's benefit. I take that to be nobility of character. But in our society, that's not the issue that's going on here. It's the autonomy bit. When the self becomes disconnected from any community, it's in trouble.
I guess I have a question for both of you, and sort of want to base this on a real-life scenario versus something hypothetical. I have friends of mine who have an 8-year-old young girl with a rare form of dwarfism, and when she was born, immediately after being born, she was put on life support, respirators, and for quite a while at the hospital, as with many committees, the recommendation was to withdraw life support, that with this form of dwarfism, quality of life is very poor, likelihood of her, you know, being able to contribute, and certainly she could not survive on her own at that point. And so the parents actually persisted and, you know, felt that her life was valuable, and, you know, 8 years later have a, you know, beautiful, intelligent young girl who is dependent on a trach, dependent on a wheelchair. There's been struggles with this family, but great joys. And you can sit and have a conversation with this young lady, and she's a joy to be around. But if 8 years ago, based on, you know, what you anticipated for this life, you had to counsel this family, what would you say to them, not knowing, you know, what's going to be down the road?
Well, I think that is a decision for the family to make. I would not really try to push them one way or the other. I would try and inform them about the prognosis as accurately as you can. I would maybe, if there are other people around with this condition, you know, who have survived and haven't, I would try to put them in touch with those people so they could judge for themselves what it is likely to work out as. But in the end, I would support them in whatever decision they made. And of course, you can say that it's fortunate that they made the decision they did because now they have this intelligent 8-year-old. But in the case of many families anyway, they have an idea about how many children they want to have. And if this child had died in infancy, there may be an intelligent, lovely 7-year-old around now who they would have had, who is not around now because they already had a child and they did not wish to have, or thought they could not perhaps cope with, another child. So I don't think the fact that you've got a lovely, intelligent 8-year-old settles the issue of whether they made the right decision or not. I think either of them were quite defensible decisions.
This is actually their third child, so they, you know, not only were they making decisions based on how their lives are going to be affected, but I mean, they're aware that a lot of the siblings of the child
are
going to be.
And a lot will depend then on the resources that they have at their command. There was a, I can't remember the title now. There was a movie I used to show my classes. It's pretty dated now, about a baby being born with spina bifida, which is a much more common condition than it is now, partly because we detect it in utero and most fetuses with that condition get aborted, but also because we've discovered that folic acid is a preventative. So, you know, and one of the interesting things in this film was that there was a conversation between a woman who had such a child and was explaining to the other woman about how, you know, it was okay and we did this and we did that and of course, you know, we would drive her here and there. But the problem was that she was this was in England, she was a wealthy woman who had a car and had the resources to do this. And this other woman was living in a public housing, could not afford a car, and was saying, well, I just can't see how we could cope. You know, we just can't do the things. So circumstances do make a difference, I think.
Yeah.
We face huge problems because the first thing to say about severely challenged children is they make or break families. There doesn't seem to be much in the middle. So you're certainly going to need a social backup where those children can be cared for institutionally or in homes, preferably, because not all families will cope. And almost any family with a seriously challenged child needs respite care fairly regularly. So there's lots to be done. But in so doing, you create community. That's what's so striking. Just to give you an illustration of how this works, I put the first feeding tube, permanent feeding tube in a CP child. We normally accepted that they were to be like that. And I realized that nobody had ever measured the efficiency of their swallowing, and it turns out to be 10% of normal. Well, you guys have to eat for an hour a day to get your energy requirements. If you had 10% feeding efficiency, you'd need 10 hours. A, you wouldn't have the physical strength to do it, and B, we couldn't afford it. So the tube was the G-tube was the way around. But it took most mothers about 2 years once they'd had one of these babies. All mothers want to care for their baby. And to find that they can't even feed it is very hard to take. So it normally takes about 2 years. And then this woman, she got there in 6 months. So in the early days, we didn't put the G-tube in straight away as you would now. We did a soft coat, Foley, and then put a button in an outpatient some weeks later. And so it came time for the button, and she arrived, and I said, look, there's no way this doesn't hurt. It's only for a minute. So he's going to cry. Do you want to go out of the clinic while I do it and then come back? And she said, no, I know what you're doing. I can hold his hand and I can comfort him. So I don't mind doing those things with parents who understand. So I put the tube in. He cried and she comforted him. And I needed to understand what was going on. I said, do you mind if I ask you some questions because you're way ahead of the curve? And then she told me this beautiful story. And she said, well, she came from a poorer part of town. She said, I married very young. I had a family. And they all grew up and went away, and I was very lonely. So God gave me a baby who will never grow up. And then she said, it's amazing what he's done. And this little guy who will never walk or talk or feed himself is civilizing a whole neighborhood. Because, of course, in the poorer parts of town, lots of kids have one parent or parents both working, they come home to an empty house, let themselves in and watch awful television. Well, now there's a little guy on the block who gets fed through a button on his belly with a syringe. That's cool. They all want to see it, they all want to try, so they all come to her house. He's teaching them to be gentle, he's teaching them to take their turn, and his mother's saying, well, there's better words than the ones you're using, even improving the local vocabulary. Now, how many of us can claim to have made that much contribution to a community?
Dr. Patrick, you said something about a cell, after fertilization, the cell is a human being as it is capable of, if left alone, developing into everything.
It's an amazing phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask more specifically about how you feel about reproductive technologies like in vitro fertilization, where they create several zygotes, and if left alone,
Have you got another hour?
I was just saying, like, if left alone, they will not develop. They need to be implanted into uterus and things like that.
Yeah, we've got millions of them in freezers, and obviously utilitarian would say use them. But the basic problem for me is that as the years have gone by, I've become more and more concerned about the reality of moral consequence. What we do makes us different people, and we often don't see quite what's involved in that at the time. I started down this track over rubella babies, where I facilitated abortions for rubella babies that were facing high risk of serious problems. And I felt no guilt at that point. It took years to realize that the few that were happening every year had grown to 50 million abortions a year worldwide, and that the consequences we hadn't thought of are popping up all over the place. The most recently brilliantly documented one is in Hungary, where there's a guy who's been arguing for years that a lot of cerebral palsy is secondary to abortion. And now the experiments have been done in Hungary because they had a huge problem, because as you probably know, behind the Iron Curtain, 7 abortions for every live birth was the average figure or thereabouts. And Hungary had vastly more cerebral palsy than any other country in Europe. They have made abortion much less available, and their rates are dropping steadily. So small for dates, premature births are dropping off. Nobody thought about that. Once you think about it, of course, it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, the cervix is not just a bit of tissue. It's rather a sensitive organ, and it has functions, and it has to go up and down in an appropriate way. If you don't do that, then it's bound to be different. So that's just one example, but you can go on and on. Again, the common good is being eroded. As you don't know yet, you haven't been there, but a children's hospital never has any trouble raising money. Because people actually love children, and you tell them the stories and they give you money. And you know, even our hockey players love making their annual visit to go around CHEO and sign autographs for all the kids. You know, it makes them feel good, I guess. But in other words, these children have a tremendous impact on society, but it's beginning to be eroded. Almost one of the last patients I saw before I stopped seeing patients, a woman came into the clinic, and she had a child with a metabolic disorder. And to be kind to the child, he was not an immediately beautiful child. He was ugly at first sight. And she'd come on the bus, and she was upset because a woman had looked at her baby and said to her, "Why didn't you have that baby aborted?" Now, how cruel can you get? But I think it was just a reflex self-defense. Almost certainly that woman had an abortion at some time for an entirely trivial reason. Then she sees a woman sacrificing, from her point of view, her life to the care of this child. Is she going to feel good about that? Of course not. So she lashed out. That's all I told her. It's understandable, but the common good is being eroded in that way. The common good is brought out so often when we struggle in one way or another. Which is not to say that I would do that, but I believe God has at least allowed it to happen, knowing in the long run what it's all about. But as the Greek said, he who has not suffered, what does he know?
But what about like the cases of choosing which embryos to implant or leftover embryos at the end of in vitro fertilization. Like, how would you feel about those or their potential?
Well, yes. Obviously, if you have a deeply religious view of life, you would at least wish them to be treated with dignity and buried appropriately, because there is going to be a freeze of failure. We don't know how long they go on, and we already know now that in vitro fertilization does not produce an exact replica of a normal child. They have more problems than normal children. So again, we're finding that our technological solutions are always come with something added to them, which often takes years to find out. You've been waiting a long time, gentlemen with the yellow shirts. You know? You get missed. I don't think it's racism, though.
No. Happens to answer that question, so it's a really, really quickly set premise of it. I think at the end of the day, when you make medical decisions such as when you're talking about, it all parts down to what is right and what is wrong. And as a Christian, I do believe that God does ultimately determine what is right or wrong, but yeah. I don't believe that working knowledge of God or Scripture is necessary for us to know what is right or wrong, no. Or else a just God would not be just and just and unbelievers, right?
Oh, yeah.
To my question, I heard Dr. Singer mention back in 1966 how death was, it took a different definition back in 1968. And in light of that, when we make life or death a relative thing or something that can be modified, who's to say where we would draw the line? When we look at fetuses who have not yet been born, we say that they haven't reached that, as you would say, bare minimum of consciousness. But everyone in this room sitting here had to go through that stage in order for us to get to a place of consciousness. So why would we not regard that stage of life just as much as we would regard this stage of life? So I guess the question would be, do we not fall into a certain danger when we make the definition of life or death more of a relative thing?
Well, I, first of all, in a moment, to allow Peter Singer to say whether he said that, because he must be amongst the most misquoted man on earth, I think. Because he often has an extremely nuanced statement, which is then cut down by the media into something that sounds almost as though he's a fascist, which is, you know, I know the risk in the science literature when you're quoted, you've only got about a 50% probability you'll be correctly quoted, but at least you've got it written down then. But these two worlds that we two represent, one of the ways in which we differ is the ordering of the goods. For a traditional Christian like me, the Georgetown mantra, just to take a very simple four-step example, is very definitely ordered. The most important thing is the negatives, what you shall not do, because those can be legislated. Thou shalt not kill. We can legislate that. You cannot legislate the positives, thou shalt love. But obviously, when you understand the negatives, you can extrapolate to those positives. And if you get some help, in my case, I certainly need help. With help, I can do it more than I can without. When that is in place, then you have a framework within which justice can happen. You have to have law to have justice. And only when justice is in place can autonomy be prevented from becoming anarchy. So not all the good things in life are equally valuable. In Canada, we've had a prime minister who seemed to think that tolerance was sufficient to deal with every problem. Now, tolerance is a virtue, but it's way down my list. The stability of society depends upon legitimate intolerance. You don't tolerate, hopefully, paedophilia or murder or theft. You do tolerate cheating, but it'd be better if you didn't, and so on. You can't use tolerance as a verb very easily with something good. If you go home to your wife and say, I'll tolerate a little love tonight, you won't make a lot of progress.
Thanks for the question. And I mean, the point of my starting off with the example of brain death and the way we've changed the definition since 1968 is really to show just how hard it is not to accept that we are making judgments about the quality of human life rather than about whether it is a human life that exists or doesn't exist. Right? Because I think it's possible to take a consistent sanctity of human lifeline, but it's very tough and very few people do it. And I think you would really have to say, I'm opposed to the change in the definition of death. I think that we have a living human being, even if the brain has irreversibly ceased to function. And I don't even think you can quite say, as Dr. Patrick did, that, well, when somebody is in the dying process, then it's okay to not meddle, to withdraw treatment. Because after all, if these people could still have months to live, or even longer, we don't really know, because even in the case of these women who were pregnant, we supported, once the baby was delivered, we ceased to support them. So we really don't have much of an idea as to how long we could keep the physical organism going after the brain has ceased to function. It might be years. But I think you would, you know, if you really want a consistent sanctity of life, you're going to have to say, that's what we ought to do. And so what I'm really saying is that when it comes down to it, when you really think about that, and it has consequences, Dr. Patrick's right to say that everything we do has consequences. If you really were to think about that and say, I'll take that line, despite the consequences that we're not going to have, you know, these organ transplants that save lives, and despite the consequences, we're going to tie up a lot of our scarce healthcare resources with keeping these human organisms alive, even though they've irreversibly lost consciousness. I think that it's better to say, more or less inevitably, we're into this quality of life view, what you call the relative view about taking life. And therefore, we have to make some decisions. They're going to be tough ones. I totally agree with Dr. Patrick that we should allow people as far as possible to make their own decisions and to find the doctors and the communities who share their values and do it with that. But I think that it's much better to be open about this and to say, now we're making decisions about whether or not to continue the life of a human being, than to try and disguise it and say, no, we're not, because this being is dead because their brain is dead, or to say, no, we're simply withdrawing treatment, we're not deciding to end their life, or to say, no, we're simply easing their pain, which is another thing doctors will say sometimes as they give large doses of morphine that they foresee will shorten life. We're just easing their suffering. We're not making a life and death decision for them. I think we like to disguise these decisions in all sorts of ways, and I think it's better to bring them out and be as open as we can with them.
Can I add one rider for that? You will know when you've reached this point. You can ask yourself the question, if I had a drug without any side effects that might kill, would I prefer it to the one that I'm currently using? If the answer is yes, then you're not doing euthanasia. If the answer is no, then clearly your intent is actually to kill. Now, the morphia one is constantly quoted. I've seen morphia go up to 1 mg/min without killing.
But this is a patient who adjusted to it.
That's right.
Had a lot of it before.
You see, you don't use morphia in huge doses instantly. You go to a palliative care unit and they'll show you how it's done. You go up slowly. You can literally go up to 1 mg/min and be perfectly conscious and speaking, but not in pain. In that setting, you don't look at the dosage. You look at the rate at which you're changing it, and you will go to whatever dose is necessary to provide comfort. Now, underlying this discussion, there is the question of the limited resources which we are going to have to deal with. It's not the doctor's job to be the gatekeeper on those resources. I have two functions. John Patrick qua physician and John Patrick qua citizen. They're different. Now, I understand, and I think that we're going to have to need to do this, that even a rich country like Canada, not long ago, we've changed it now, but for a while we didn't do certain transplants. They were not available in Canada. Now, I have no problem with that. That's justice. Now, of course, it's a pseudo-justice in that the wealthy could afford to go to the States and get it, but it's the way you have to go. I mean, Ontario is shortly going to reach the point where it spends more than 50% of its provincial budget on health. There's a limit. We cannot go on forever. So we're going to have to start thinking about all sorts of other forms of limiting health services, but not at an individual level. We're going to have to do the hard thinking as citizens. Health accounts, taking responsibility for your behavior, not having very expensive procedures go through the to get to treatment very quickly. Now, my son-in-law has last year published one of the first papers that has demonstrated actually some treatment for gastrointestinal cancers that works biochemically. But it's $30,000 a course at the moment. That's got to stay as a research project for a while until, you know, we can make the stuff cheaper.
I actually wanted to, I guess it's sort of a follow-up. I want to know what both of you think about this. It's a question about scarce resources in a more immediate context, not with the long-term system consequences, but a situation such as if you have an influenza pandemic, you know, a huge spike in respiratory illness. Many people coming for treatment who need a respirator.
Yeah,
and there's you know, quite a limited number. Only some people are going to be able to be treated. And at least some of the states in the United States have been thinking about this and trying to plan for this. Yeah. Have come up with guidelines that say there should be some sort of medical assessment of people, even those who might already be on one of these ventilator respirator apparatus, to say if they're unlikely to have a long their prognosis is poor. They're unlikely to have a long life, but you could save another person with that same piece of equipment.
Yeah.
But if you fail to remove them right away, that other person will die.
Yeah.
How do you deal with those kinds of decisions?
Well, that came up right at the beginning of dialysis, when obviously we had limited access to dialysis, and we tried initially to make those quality decisions. We very quickly stopped. A, we're not good enough at doing it, and B, the burden was immense. It had to become, what are the clinical criteria that make it appropriate? First come, first served. And that way we could live. But you simply couldn't live as a physician when it was a limited resource, being forced to judge the value of people every day. It's not doable. So that's what happened. Of course, very rapidly, we built up the system. In fact, it was amusing to me that Reagan had to sign the first national health program in the U.S. because he made dialysis a right for all Americans, because of course it wouldn't drive anybody except Bill Gates into bankruptcy. But we can't provide everything to everybody. When I first went to Africa, I was amazed on my first trip, which was 3 years, that the mission hospital that I went to help had never actually asked the question, how much money does this population have to spend on health? And what could I set up that would be viable in that context? Well, the people lived on a dollar a day. There's very little you can do. Professor Singer was pointing about some of the things you could do. Even oral rehydration solution is not the best way to go because it's too expensive. It's actually better to cook your rice in twice the normal amount of water, and the fluid that's left over is a perfect oral rehydration solution. Better than ORS.
Cheaper still then. But I mean, I think, you know, I don't really disagree with Dr. Patrick's answer, because it was a pragmatic answer. It was basically saying it's too difficult in the case of those situations to work out maybe who you ought to choose over someone else. And that may be the case. I mean, it will probably depend on the situation, but it certainly could be the case. And you might take first come, first serve as a pragmatic rule, because you might say, otherwise, we're just going to mess things up. But, you know, if you're a philosopher and you have the luxury of thinking about abstract examples, and, you know, we can do this, we can draw up a list of 10 patients, and, you know, one of them is a criminal with many violent crimes and is going to be in jail for the next 40 years, and another is a brilliant scientist who's already made important discoveries and is likely to make others. So, you know, in that way, we could say, well, I do think it would be better to put the scientist on the respirator than the criminal. You know? I mean, I don't disagree with that ethically, but cases are not presented in the heat of medical practice with that sort of precision or with that sort of full information.
You know that, by the way, that in China they shoot criminals to order now.
For their organs.
Yes. I had a colleague who does heart transplants, and he was asked to go to China. And he said, I can't sit around waiting for a transplant. And they said, you won't sit around. They'll be available. He refused to go when he discovered why.
Yeah, I was at a conference where somebody had done it, presented the details of a research project, which showed there's a period in May, I think, when Japanese take holidays. There was a correlation between that, which was and when condemned prisoners were being executed in China, because the organs were then being sold. I think the Japanese were going somewhere else, like the Philippines, and the organs were being sent to them there. And clearly, people were making money from the organs.
So this is just a tidying up remark. I have a lot of things to say, but I won't say them. But here's a tidying up remark that I think there are two questions. One's about the circle of people who are creatures who are fully morally considerable. And then I often do this, I draw it on the board. And then there are concentric circles that maybe people have less moral, creatures have more less moral status when you get out of the most valuable, the ones, creatures that have the most moral considerability or the highest moral status. There's a question about where to draw that line. Some people think that surely down children should be in it and so forth. That's one discussion. There have been proposals like, oh, it's got to be human and only human. And I always give hypothetical cases. If there were Martians who had the same mental life as us, they wouldn't be human, but they shouldn't be out of the circle. So it can't be human. That's not the way to draw the line. So now it's a challenge. What is the other way? The same thing happens when, I think Peter Singer says to John Patrick, you said that it's always wrong to bring about the death of a human being. And I have a counterexample. And he gives this counterexample at the beginning of his lecture about people who are living, but they don't have any brain. They're brain dead, but they're living, he says. And it's a counterexample to your principle. And now the ball's in your court to come up with a positive view, because he's just defeated the view that you had first stated. So it goes like this. There are counterexamples against views, and now the ball's in your court to come up with a better view. That's one thing. This, back to the circle. Suppose we decided this is the circle of those that are maximally morally considerable. There's a question about utilitarianism. That's come up a number of times. You're inside the circle now. There's a question about whether you could sacrifice, whether it's sometimes wrong to sacrifice some for the greater good. I'm not a utilitarian. Peter and I think disagree about this inside the circle, but let's keep those questions separate. What are the moral principles that operate inside that circle? What is the line that draws the circle? And what are the principles that operate between the concentric circles? That's the lay of the land, I think.
Yes, that's right. I agree with you. And of course, as a Christian, I know that I'm not going to get it all right. But what I believe is that God looks at my intentions. And if I screw up, I make what recompense I can make. And at that point, I move on, because ultimately, I'm responsible for being obedient to my conscience.
Yes, but John, I think what you don't do is respond to a counterexample. Peter seems to have a counterexample against the view.
No, I just think always that, that removal, the heart transplant one is not true, because we do in fact allow the heart to stop before we remove pointless treatment. I have no problem with transplant.
Sorry, why is it pointless? It keeps a human being alive. Well, why do you say it's pointless to keep a human being alive?
Because people have said that my life is in God's hands, and if you take away these artificial resources and he wishes to keep me alive, he can, and they're happy
suppose
autonomy in your sense. Christians will say that.
But suppose I've just been hit by a bus and I'm only temporarily unconscious and I'm on, but I need the life support now. You wouldn't say, well, we can take the life support away because everybody's life is in God's hands.
No, nothing. This is when we're looking at what it appears to be a terminal state.
But it's not a terminal state.
No, not the bus one.
Even what I'm saying is, the person who's been declared brain dead is not in a terminal state. They could live for 6 months. They could live maybe for a year. We don't really know because we don't try. How many people have we really tried to keep alive as long as we can?
I was actually reported in Morris Papler's Human Guinea Pigs for being involved in a child we kept alive for many years, actually. Mm. And learned a lot about the autonomic nervous system in the process. But the way we focus on the end of our lives, the big difference, and one of the areas where certainly Christians ought to go to their churches and demand that they set up a power of attorney for people there, is that obviously if you have no life but this life, you can make a case for having it go on as long as possible. As you probably well know, you cannot take an Orthodox Jew off a respirator. So that's a very particular case. We've had to go to court in Canada to do that. Now, I think, to take my own case, if I have a serious illness, you might go on a respirator while you work out what it is. Now, I have absolutely no problem with the point of saying, well, this is a disease in which I cannot live without mechanical support. You are never required to take a treatment that is burdensome to you. There is not a duty unless there are other people who will be severely damaged by that process. So I can withdraw. I was reprimanded by my children when I said that I've done my duty and brought you lot up. I can exit at will. And they said, no, you can't. You've got grandchildren who want you around as long as possible. So there are going to be some negotiations. It's not straightforward. But the sense that the sovereignty of God should play a major role in my moment of death, rather than the physician, is what I want. I want to die at home with my family around my bed. I do not wish to have the experience of dying in an intensive care unit. And I think churches in particular should get a doctor, a lawyer, and a woman like my wife, who won't take no for an answer, to form a patient advocacy committee so that they can go to local intensive care unit. Because most of the stuff that we object to is being done by doctors, not for the benefit of the patients, but to prevent their own attack, themselves being attacked by lawyers. So if somebody arrives with a legitimate power of attorney and says, this person is at peace with God, does not need this kind of intervention at the end of their life, it's burdensome treatment, withdraw it, they can do it.
I'm going to take two more questions and then we're going to close it down. I do apologize for triaging here. Hey, Beck, you had a question earlier.
Dr. Patrick, you discussed two aspects. One about whether you could really decide a moral right, because it seems like people, it's not written and decided this is one moral
right. It's different in different places, yeah. The principles are always there, but they have to be applied within a cultural context.
Right. You've also mentioned several times that someone who chooses to not believe in abortion should have the right to see a provider who shares their belief. So do you believe the opposite of that is true?
Of course. I think we are so divided. I usually draw a Venn diagram. When I started in medicine, one circle defined what was ethical medicine. The moment abortion was made a legal right, we had two circles. And you go on down that process. We're moving towards the point where we will have two very distinctly different communities. And that will, because medicine is ultimately a moral activity, because when a patient comes to see me, they never have to take my advice. So what I am doing is helping them to decide what they ought to do. That's a moral activity, not a technical one. So the moral commitments of the patient have to be taken much more seriously than they've been taken so far. Ethics in particular has to be taught from a cultural point of view, not a multicultural point of view. I have never seen and will never see a multicultural patient. There is no such beast. I need to understand what their real understandings are and work to its strengths and avoid its weaknesses. And it will, I think, it will divide the healthcare system. And we'll be much more at peace with one another that way around. We have it already, as Professor Singer pointed out. The Catholic Church in America is holding on to a degree. There are people who would like to close it down. I think they actually need to broaden that. The so-called Baptist and Methodist hospitals, of course, are now more Baptist or Methodist than any other. It's just a name that's left. But we do need to keep a constant watch on what the belief systems of the state are and adjust the healthcare system to it.
One more question.
Okay, I've got a kind of a comment I'd like to hear Singer's response to. It seems to me that the relevant difference between the unconscious fetus and the brain dead patient is that the unconscious fetus has the potential for a future mental life, and the brain dead patient doesn't have that potential. How would you respond to that?
You're right, that is the difference. And so the question is whether having the potential for life is enough to get you to have a right to life, if you wouldn't want to put it in those terms. And my argument was that it's not. It's not enough, at least, in a world in which we have as many people as we think it can reasonably hold. It might be different in a world that was severely underpopulated. But at the moment, I think it's not. And just as I think there is no obligation to bring more children into the world by conceiving children and having them, so I think there is no obligation of that sort to bring a fetus into the world merely because the fetus already exists.
Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause.